Greetings, all of you. Good to be with you here on the tundra. I'm from the south, and this is pretty amazing. There's a few times scheduled in for, you know, people from below a certain latitude to go play in it. Nonetheless, I'm glad to be with you. Thank you for coming. Just tell you briefly about myself. I grew up working in youth ministry for a number of years, for more than a decade, in fact, in a variety of local churches, and then retooled as something of an academic. Did graduate work at Emory, and now teaching at Duke Divinity School. I teach education-related courses and youth ministry courses. I also direct Duke's Youth Academy for Christian Formation. There's some shameless self-promotion there in front of you that describes the Youth Academy, and I'll say more about it as we go through the hour today. I'd love to hear from you and where you're from and what you're up to. The time doesn't really allow for that, but if something you hear today intrigues you or irritates you, I hope that you'll feel free to continue to be in conversation with me, either as you see me around here the next couple of days, or you can find my email address on the Divinity School website. Glad to continue the conversation. So, you're here, I'm guessing, because, like me, A, you care about young people in the church, or young people who need to be in the church, and B, you care something about the feast that we variously describe as Holy Communion, or Lord's Supper, or the language I've come to use, Eucharist. Or at least you're curious about the possibilities here. So those are some presumptions that we'll just begin with without really having to defend or otherwise describe. My training is in areas of formation and in areas of liturgical theology. So when Duke contacted me about 8 years ago and said, "We want to establish a program for high school students. What would you do?" I said, you know, basically all I knew at that time was the liturgy. And I said, well, I'd shape it around the liturgy. And they thought that was appropriately odd and decided to bring me on. And 8 years later, we've begun to think that we know some things that are worth sharing with other folks. I should also say that in my time as a youth worker, I became increasingly frustrated with what seemed like an overly gadgety approach to youth ministry in the church. And I didn't know exactly what I was looking for, but I knew that we needed to work at entering the post-gadget era. And so that's a piece of my story that's important for what we do together today. So what I want to do with you, copy my handout, is to address the theme of youth living Eucharistically. And I see my task at the Youth Academy and as a teacher of aspiring youth workers and as at least in a limited way, a youth worker still myself, I see my task as creating what I call formationally rich environments. And I want to use the language of ecosystem as a supportive image here. So in an ecosystem, and I'm just taking this from the science of ecology, in an ecosystem, you know that all the constituent members of a particular ecosystem contribute to the richness and the vitality of the whole. So just imagine this, that a woodland ecosystem, there are trees, there's a certain kind of soil with organisms underneath or within the soil, there are certain animals that are dependent upon the cover that the trees provide, there are birds that live in the trees. You get how the whole thing works together, that all of these pieces fit into the whole. In addition, the constituent members of this ecosystem are interdependent. certain animals depend upon certain other animals or certain vegetation in order for everything to flourish. Now, when you lose a member of an ecosystem, it's not only that particular member that is lost, but the whole system is diminished. So, you know, why is it that in my suburban tract house in Durham, North Carolina, deer are showing up eating our perennials? Damn it! You know, why is that? Well, it's partly because instead of habitat, we got a bunch of suburban tract houses. All right, that's one. So the whole habitat is diminished. I mean, there's less space for the deer to do what deer do naturally. And then another part of this, I suspect, is because we ran all the wolves off, right? The wolves that might otherwise take care of some of the deer are no longer around because they simply can't operate in the suburbs. Now, interestingly, we have foxes. We have a dog that's about this big. And when she goes out, the first thing she does on the front porch is just bark like crazy, as if to say to the foxes, "I'm tough, I can handle it." And so far, she's been all right. But I digress. So this ecosystem, the reason that the deer are all out of kilter and eating our perennials is because other pieces of the ecosystem have been lost. So I want to spin this positively and say that the opposite is also true, that if we can think about environments of formation as ecosystems, that the more pieces we have in place, the better results or the better potential for the Christian formation of young people, and their parents too, by the way. So, I have just made my way into the 20th century, and so I have technology. So I want to show you this diagram as a starting point. Come on, baby. All right, let's go back. Okay, so here we go. This is what I suggest is an ecological model for formation. And at the center, you see the odd word ordo. I don't want you to get overly lost on that. Ordo is Latin. It, you know, is at the root of order. We could think of ordo as describing a pattern of worship. And that pattern would consist of the interrelationship between book, bath, table, and time. I'm using very general language here, but you can see the associations with the church's particular language. Book as our holy scriptures, bath as our baptismal waters, the table pointing to the Eucharistic table, and time, the patterning, the Christian patterning of time. The fact that we worship on the Lord's Day, for example. The fact that we celebrate Jesus' death and resurrection at a certain time during the year. So this I put at the center. Worship that is grounded in these four holy things and their practice. Now, one thing to notice briefly here is that ordo-grounded worship itself constitutes a kind of ecology where each of these holy things is interdependent with the others. In the history of Christendom, traditions have tended to forget about or otherwise edit out certain dimensions of this ecology. So for a great period of time in Roman Catholicism, the book seemed to fall out of liturgical use. For a long period of time in Protestantism, and I would say unfortunately, the table has fallen out of liturgical use. And I'm suggesting here, and not sure what to do about that. I guess I would need to change the energy setting. But I'm suggesting that each of these four practices in worship is crucial to the health of the others and helps the others to speak and enact more faithfully Jesus Christ for the world. So what would robust worship look like? And thinking that along right now, just in light of the table, what would robust... Yes, sir?
Yes, I understand reading, but what is to do with our existence? What?
I'll get to that one. I'm going that way. So what does robust Eucharistic practice consist of? Here are some thoughts. Robust Eucharistic practice incorporates elements of graceful meal sharing in community. And what does that look like? Well, it means that in our worship space, that our Eucharistic practice is discernibly like a meal. That the table is prepared with graciousness and care. That fulsome grace is said, a grace that recalls, for example, much or all of God's past saving work. A graceful meal is one in which the host welcomes guests and they're made to feel at home. A graceful meal is one in which there is enough food for all to partake, but not too much. You know, this isn't... y'all have... never mind. I was going to talk about an all-you-can-eat restaurant that's, I think, local to Durham. But it's not... there's enough for all, but not too much. And if there are leftovers, those are saved to be offered to persons who were not able to attend the meal or at least return to the earth from whence they came. So these are things that we all of us recognize, even in the midst of all our different contexts, that graceful meal sharing consists of certain kinds of practices. And so long, to the extent that our Eucharistic meal partakes of those practices, it is a robust and fulsome one. Now, maybe the best way to illustrate this is to talk about all the ways that this can go wrong. I'm aware of congregations that have huge worshiping, huge numbers of worshipers, so they have taken to using these little plastic packets. You know, it's like one of those Cheese Whiz kind of things where you get the little plastic, you know, you peel back the top and you scoop out the cheese-related product and you scoop it, you spread it onto the cracker. Well, I've seen just that in Eucharistic practice where people peel back the top and, you know, there's a little shot glass and a little wafer and it's all disposable and everybody gets a packet and then we go. Well, logistically, that may make sense in the worshiping life of a community. You know, if you have 2,000 persons at worship, that means... But from the standpoint of what makes for gracious or graceful meal sharing in community, that's an abomination. All right? So a Eucharistic meal that looks like fast food to go does not express the fullness of meal sharing in community. There are other kinds of theological problems here, but before we even go to theology, that's just problematic. My son was once an acolyte at our Methodist church, and the problem in this particular Methodist church was that we had lots of folks in a recently expanded sanctuary, but a very old and small communion rail where people kneeled to receive bread and juice. And so the solution to this, what was happening at the communion rail was that people were, you know, drinking from their little glasses and then putting them on the rail, but the rail was getting so full that nobody had a place to put their little communion glasses, and they were falling on the floor, staining the carpet, and the altar guild, you know, was perplexed. So the solution that was devised was a white trash can with a white liner. And the acolyte was to subtly go around and pick up the empty glasses so that in between servings, so that people would have a place, you know, to put their glasses. Well, my son, you know, overachieving little creature that he was, people could barely get their glasses back down to the rail when he was grabbing them and so it was going plink, 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 you know. So another example where perhaps not the best or most graceful practice of meal sharing in community was exhibited. So I'm pushing for the other, a sense of hospitality, that we have time for this, that all are welcome within limits, that all are fed. That's what I'm pushing for, talking about robust practices of meal sharing in community. Okay, we'll go on into the rest, other parts of the ecology. So what should I do now? Oh, great, great. Okay, you see, I'm pretty excited about the whole arrow thing. Y'all don't know how big this is. All right. I want to go here to the issue of teaching. Teaching on the significance of the Eucharistic meal as part of the ecology. I forgot one piece here. A third dimension here would be youth engaged, actively engaged in the Eucharistic meal. That to the extent your tradition allows, youth would be invited to acolyte, to have close proximity to these holy things, to assist the host in preparation of the meal, to be what in some traditions would be called a lay Eucharistic minister, one who could share the elements under the supervision of the ordained person. Youth could be involved in the musical offerings during the Eucharistic celebration. The deal is that the closer they are to the action, the more credibility the action may assume in their imaginations. All right, now on to the teaching. Yeah. So, teaching. One dimension of this teaching could simply be a kind of exploration of what we just did, of rich meal sharing in community. So a question to youth. Tell the story of a wonderful and memorable meal. And youth invited to tell those stories, and then to begin to think together about what are the dimensions that made those meals memorable. Well, you can imagine what they would come up with. The loveliness of the preparation, or the association of the meal with some significant event in the family or community life, the goodness of the food, the care that the host takes to make people welcome. You know, the list could go on and on. But what you're doing in asking for that sort of reflection would be then to make the next move, that all the dynamics you just described are at least ideally part of the Eucharistic celebration. That Eucharist is, at its root, sharing of a meal in community. Another way that you could expand youth's understanding of the Eucharistic meal would be to ask them simply to brainstorm about feasts, feasting, meals, bread, wine, in the scriptures. There are multiple Old Testament stories of such. The manna in the wilderness, you know, on and on and on. Multiple New Testament stories of such. Who Jesus eats with, what that may say about the nature of the kingdom of God that Jesus promises. The other thing that does is helps youth to understand how Jesus' celebration of the Last Supper and our continued celebration of the Eucharistic meal participates in these stories of God's saving activity. The Eucharistic meal takes into it for example, the stories of God's provision of manna in the wilderness for those who were wandering. It takes into it, help me, what's another good meal-related story?
Feeding of the 5,000.
The feeding of the 5,000, where all are welcome and all are made full. So it situates the Eucharistic meal within this unfolding story of God's salvation. And you can already see where we would go next. We might talk about more explicitly theological themes. How does the meal partake of or enact covenant? How does the meal constitute the church as Christ's body? How does the meal enact God's reign? A reign where all will be fed, where all, you know, where if the fancy folks don't show up, the outsiders, the marginalized, will be invited to sit down. At the Youth Academy, we use what we call the list of theological alliterative C's. Creation, crisis, covenant, Christ, and Christ in multiple dimensions, Christ as incarnate, Christ's passion, Christ's resurrection. But then also church, calling, coming reign of God, kind of cheating on that one. But you see that if you want to take time to explore, that the Eucharist has theological resonance with all those theological themes. Okay, so I'm sort of racing. I need to stop a minute and exhale. And questions or comments at this point about teaching in relation to... Yes, sir?
I have a question. All this teaching you're talking about this morning is based on the youth partake the communion or not, because I'm from different denominations.
Well, it assumes with this ecological model, it assumes that all of this is going on in relationship with. That each of these practices is going on in relationship with the other practices. So it assumes that young people are regularly partaking of the Eucharistic meal. It's not a linear model. It's not first we do this, then we do this, then we do this. It's more like full court press, but it just assumes that all of these pieces are operating. What's the word I'm looking for?
Holistically. More of a Hebrew.
Yes. Yes, and that they're linked to one another. All right.
Can I ask you a question?
Certainly.
Forgive me if this was covered. I was a few minutes late. I apologize. But are you defining chronologically where you define youth? Because a lot of people would give you youth starts at 10, youth starts at 8, youth starts at... First, depending on faith tradition, you start at confirmation. I mean, how do you answer that? Because that can get to be a real sticky point in different faith traditions.
About when young people...
About when a person transitions kind of from child to youth. And I mean, my first thought in all of this is why not push it back and have children at some level? I mean, I'm wanting to expand this further to say, in my mind, children should be... And there's different faith traditions that have different answers to that, I understand that. But in my mind, children should be welcome at the table as well. And I'm coming from a Reformed background, so I'm acknowledging that others are different than that. But
yeah.
Just how do you approach that kind of age issue?
Well, I would be inclined to try to think theologically about this. And I'm inclined to, for reasons I can't really develop at the moment, if persons are baptized, I think that means that they are fully incorporated into Christ's body and therefore ought to be nourished at the table. But we can talk about that.
Yeah, I know that's a bigger question. So are you approaching this, though, with a... So you're using the term youth kind of in a general...
Yeah, I guess I haven't... I'm thinking about teenagers.
Okay.
But I think that the ecology I'm describing is one that is potentially helpful for children and adults as
okay.
well.
Thank you.
Sure. So we'll go on maybe and... I'm so polished. So...
That is a cool arrow thing.
Oh, thanks.
I'm really disappointed that that's not on here.
But you can turn the RFC off.
That would help.
It would stay on.
All right, don't worry about it. It'll give us something right about
does.
On your evaluation. All right, so...
shut off the screensaver.
Yeah. So now, we've talked about teaching, and we're going to move to this cleverly phrased bubble here, ordinary practice. And what I'm suggesting here is that worship as is, in fact, the heart of a community's life, and that if we take time to notice, we can see how our worshiping practices inspire and rehearse and actually enact other dimensions of a church's life, other ways of being a community of faith. And so, for example, here's an example. This is one that you'll be familiar with. The offering of hospitality. The practice of hospitality is inspired and empowered by way of our Eucharistic reception and offering, our enactment of hospitality in the Eucharist. So when your young people go to a community homeless shelter and prepare a meal and then sit down with persons who come to the shelter to receive the meal, eat the meal, share conversation, that is a Eucharistically inspired practice. But the trick is that, and we'll get to this in a moment, that we need to help people notice that that is in fact the case. Something that you no doubt have done in your faith community. When the youth group invites the elders and the saints of the congregation to come and share their stories and to sit down and eat together. So here is a practice of the youth offering hospitality to the elders in the congregation, a chance to hear their stories, what the church was like when, what it was like to be Christian back when. That is a Eucharistically inspired practice. Other possibilities. The practice of gleaning, which in my part of the country has become a really robust ministry of the church. You know about gleaning from the Old Testament, that those who landowners were supposed to not harvest a percentage of their crop so that the poor could come in after the harvesting was completed and glean what was left over so that they could be fed. Well, in my part of the country, there is an organization called the Society of St. Andrew. I think, in fact, they're a national organization. And you could probably find them on the internet. And what they do is they work with farmers who, for whatever reasons, have crops to share. It's a messed up economy out there, because if a crop comes in, say, even 10 days too late, it can become economically disadvantageous for a farmer to harvest it. He can't make enough money because he missed the market window, so it actually becomes cheaper just to plow the stuff in instead of harvesting it. So whole fields, for example, go unharvested. Well, the Society of St. Andrew works with those folks and says, we got 100 teenagers, can we come harvest your cantaloupes? And the farmer says, well, they're just going to go to waste. So in go the 100 teenagers to harvest all they can, and then that food is distributed to area food banks, and it's given to food insecure people. It's used in shelters and such. So, yes, ma'am.
I was just going to mention another idea is this summer we're doing the Heifer Project, the Heifer Ranch in Arkansas, and I work with kids in the city, so this is really putting them in touch with where food comes from and how it's distributed. And so we're really looking forward to that.
Thanks for sharing. Heifer Project is another organization that is similar to what I'm describing. And you see what happens in this the practice itself embeds food within a context. I mean, we are people who eat food that comes from nowhere. We go to the grocery store in this country and, you know, we get bananas and sweet potatoes and meat. And that food, where does it come from? It comes from the grocery store, right? But what this Gleaning Project does is it invites you to re-embed or recontextualize their food. They see that in collard greens come from a plant that grows out of the ground, and if they look over to the neighboring field, they see, in my part of the country, they see immigrant workers being paid very little to harvest that food that's there in the grocery store. So they get schooled in economics. Potentially they get schooled in just or unjust practices related to food. They get schooled in just how hard it is to be a farmer in a country that subsidizes some crops to excess and other crops not at all. Okay, so another practice that I think related to a Eucharistic practice. So now, I've already begun to do this. The next move is to talk about the intentional juxtaposition of our worshiping life with our extra liturgical life with our teaching. So what would it mean not only for you to take your youth gleaning or to involve your youth with livestock or other kinds of agricultural practices through the Heifer Project? What would it mean for you to do that, say go for a day of gleaning, and then to worship in that field, and your worship to include Eucharist? For someone to preach on the biblical texts related to gleaning, to talk about the Old Testament's concern for justice, to talk about how Jesus only deepens the concerns for justice, and then to point in your preaching to this Eucharistic meal as a practice of justice, as empowering our just practices. So the trick would be, not the trick, that sounds cheap, the strategy here in this ecology of formation is to practice these in close enough proximity to one another that persons are able to take note of the relationships. And when I take note of the relationship, not only is my appreciation for and my practice of Eucharist deepened, Eucharist means just food systems. Eucharist means this vision of the reign of God where all are fed. But so is my practice of gleaning, for example, deepened. I do this because Jesus feeds me at his table. So you're creating this robust, thick ecology where these different practices deepen and interpret one another. Stop right there. Questions? Yes, sir.
I'm admittedly not all that familiar with sort of the doctrine and theology of the Eucharist and how it's practiced in various religious traditions. But I'm sort of hearing two different things that I feel like I need to get cleared up for the rest of the talk. One is the Eucharist being the inspiration for meals like the example you gave with a homeless shelter or something, where it's an extension and hospitality of welcoming all. And then also the Eucharist being, I think you said, I don't remember what you said exactly, but it restricted in some sense. Like we talked about baptism, we talked about members of churches only,
yeah,
et cetera.
Yeah.
How is, and then I'm thinking, okay, the original institution is Jesus and his 12 disciples in the upper room, which, I mean, from my understanding of the text, it's only them. And this is where the institution of the Eucharist happens. And all of the other meals that we talked about, they were hospitable and welcoming and communal meals, but they were not Jesus literally partaking of, or at least, you know, using the analogy of his blood and his body and being... I'm just wondering some of the differences, maybe. Does it make sense at all? I'm kind of fumbling for the exact question, but...
No, no, I understand what you're... I think I understand what you're asking.
Because I hear you saying the Eucharist is the inspiration of welcoming, and but then people should be baptized or members of the church, and...
This issue of the degree of the openness of the Eucharistic table or the limits on the openness of the Eucharistic table, different traditions answer differently. Some traditions believe in a completely open table, that if in the time of Eucharistic sharing you are seeking to be in right relationship with the triune God and with your neighbor, come on and eat. Other traditions say no, that the Eucharistic meal is a meal for the baptized. It's to nourish us in our baptismal lives. I can't solve that for you. I do think that certainly, well, two things. One is that my interest here is expanding the possibilities of Eucharistic meaning and practice. I think that so often when you ask young people, what's Holy Communion mean? They say, well, it's a sign that Jesus died for me. And that is true, okay? I don't mean to imply otherwise, but that is inadequate. That's not all that the Eucharist means. I mean, if you read the Emmaus account, you get an account, it seems to be an account of a Eucharistic gathering where not only is Jesus remembered, but his living presence is encountered. The meal is about Jesus' life, death, and his resurrection presence. The meal is about the reign of God. The meal is about a certain kind of covenantal relationship that the community bears together. It's all those things. So my impetus is expansive. With regard to the particular question you're asking, I don't know that limitations on access to the Eucharistic meal necessarily hinders this ecology, at least from the standpoint of the church.
Yeah, I think what you said earlier answers what I was thinking. I was trying to see, maybe like when you use the word Eucharist, what exactly are you talking about? Makes sense to me that you're just talking about a broader understanding of the more concepts of it as the whole and sort of thing, rather than specific practice.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
Yes, sir. I kind of want to bring out an assumption that I think is, I totally want to say amen to it, but I want to bring it out for the benefit of all. I think that you're in your whole structure of your argument, you're kind of making a kind of a radical claim and a radical statement, which differs from a lot of what churches have practiced, which is that all are significant in the ministry of the church. That it isn't somehow ministry begins when you are confirmed, or ministry begins when you're an adult, but ministry begins and your place at the table begins at whatever point, different faith traditions. But you're making a strong claim, and I just want to bring it out, that youth are important in the life of the church. Too often I think the church has, and I don't want to get onto my soapbox here, but I feel passionately that a lot of times we've, as somewhat arrogant adults, made the claim that we teach the youth, they don't teach us. And the youth are over there in that building, in that room, and that's the youth room, and that's the youth program. Well, I disagree. The youth are part of the body of Christ, and they're part of the church, and they don't belong over there somewhere. They belong here in our midst, with their own space, but integrated into our midst. I just want to bring that out.
I wholeheartedly agree. And so this is, this model, I'm describing one dimension of it, but the whole model is about bringing youth to the center of congregational life.
That's
And the center of congregational life is its practice of corporate worship. And in the next hour, I'm going to talk about why baptism makes us all ministers, and not just the folks who wear robes. And to build upon what your comment in one other way, youth have particular gifts that are essential to the health of the body. They snip out hypocrisy better than children or adults. They have a sense of the possible. They've not yet been beat down like the rest of us. And they might actually believe that the reign of God could come on earth. They have physical strength, and at least in this country, a modicum of time that would enable them to go gleaning, for example, whereas other people are working 50-hour weeks doing something else. And in that practice, not only are they practicing a more just way of life consonant with the Christian vision for the reign of God, they are exercising a kind of prophetic activity. That, look, there's a better way for us to live, and we're engaged in it. So the whole church needs that. We fat and happy and beat up on adults need that from them. So thanks for bringing that out. All right. Yes, sir.
I like your concept of no matter what tradition you are, children come to the table as children or as adults. I like the idea of expanding their sacramental imagination. I mean, no matter what you're doing, you're preparing them. So many times after a sermon, I'll finish and think, this would be perfect now if we had communion, but, you know, we're going to do that every week, and maybe every month if we're lucky. But I haven't changed that pattern. I like leaving it that everyone thinks, we probably should have communion. Kind of expand the imagination until one day maybe we're ready. So I appreciated that part of just helping you get ready or fulfill what they're already doing. It's a concept.
An example that would be, I think, support your comment. I was teaching at a youth worker training event. There were 300 or 400 youth workers. This was in Texas. Everything's big in Texas. Well, it is pretty big. And so it's the last worship of the week, and this guy, this wonderful preacher, tells this moving story about meeting a homeless person who felt himself unworthy to be in conversation with this minister. And as the story ended, it ended up that the homeless person was sharing the bread and the cup with the minister. You know, this reversal of power and glorious illustration of the reign of God come, you know, a glimpse of the reign of God. And, you know, it was just so powerfully pointing at the table. Like, and I'm going, yeah, you know, it must mean that Eucharist is coming, because he wouldn't. And what happens next is the rock band gets up and confetti falls out of the ceiling.
Oh, no.
All right? And everybody goes nuts. You know, and no, I'm not suggesting that God was not worshipped. But I am suggesting that an opportunity for deepened formation was lost. And we don't worship. We worship to offer our gratitude and praise to God. We don't worship primarily to form folks. But whether we want to or not, whether we're aware or not, our worshiping practices do form. So why not form folks in the distinctiveness and the gracefulness and the giftedness of what the church has to offer? Jesus Christ for the world, enacted in and through holy things. Why not do that? Then confetti. And then light. All right.
Can I just interject one more thing?
Sure.
No,
sure.
We're good.
Time here. I'm sort of fat.
As,
we're good.
As being a person who is not all that far out from what we're talking about as youth right now, with this thing, you know, if anyone's sitting here thinking, well, you know, my kids won't be into that, or my kids won't, like, you know, thinking like this deeply, this theologically, I would say that is definitely not true. When youth say that church is boring, It's because we do stuff like the Eucharist, and they don't know what we're talking about right now. They don't know what why we do it. And so, like, and if you talk to them about it, they are so interested in it. I am so interested in it. It's just, and if you tell them why, and maybe for a lot of us, it means that we need to know why first. But if we tell them why, all of a sudden church isn't boring anymore, because God is not boring.
Amen.
Like, all this stuff we're talking about right now is so, it's so interesting and so important.
Nice. I agree. So, we've talked about now I got a whole nother thing going on.
Oh, we lost the color.
See, this is where I was trying to be. This was way out of my league. I was trying, sorry. Y'all got a glimpse of what might have been. I'm at the computer, arrows, and my 17-year-old daughter saying, "Would you just let me do it?" another 100 years, I'll be there. So I want to mention the reflection. That this was another of the bubbles, reflection. So not only is it important that all the practices of the ecology that we've described are in fact being practiced, and not only is it important that they be practiced in intentional proximity to one another, but it's also important that young people have opportunities to reflect on what's going on. And I'll just offer a few questions that might open them to that kind of reflection. So, some general and then more specific questions. Where was God in our worship leadership last night? How were you surprised by what God did in and through worship? What have you discovered about yourself? And we could qualify this. What have you discovered about yourself while engaged in Eucharistic worship? What relationship did you sense between the scriptures and preaching and our sharing in Eucharist? Just asking you to make that connection if it wasn't self-evidently happening already. Here's another Eucharistic kind of question. What do Eucharistic gestures signal about incarnation? Here's a case-specific question that we use at the Youth Cast. How did our preparing the meal for the AIDS community today, then dining with them, affect your receiving Eucharist tonight? We worship every day at the Youth Academy. It's always a Lord and table gathering. So again, the practice, which would have been a powerful practice, preparing this meal and sitting, there's a residence in Durham where persons with AIDS live, and they get nursing care and such. And sitting at the table, we ask persons to tell some of their stories, how they came to be here. And inevitably, the students hear about dimensions of suffering that they hadn't previously perhaps encountered. So the question, how did that factor into your engagement with that? And inviting them to share, to tell their stories. Another Youth Academy specific question. After nearly 2 weeks of daily Eucharist, how is your appreciation for the meal changing? So that's 2 weeks of daily, that's more Eucharist than lots of kids get in a year or unless you're an overachieving Episcopalian or something, it's more than you get in a year of Sundays. So the daily practice. And these young people they're both what Zach described as in open to exploring, but they also, most of them, come as knee-jerk Protestant iconoclasts, okay? They come thinking, I'm a Methodist. I'm not supposed to like ritual. because we don't know what we are, we Methodists, but we know we're not Catholic. You know, that's how it goes in my part of the country. So they come thinking that this is a boring practice, a lifeless practice, or it may even be a dangerous practice because it gets in the way of my relationship with Jesus. Mm-hmm. That these people are making me do this ritual rather than connect with Jesus. And we sort of welcome all that and say, yeah, we hear you. But here's, you know, the body of Christ for you. The blood of Christ for you. And over 2 weeks' time, doing that every day, some of them go from Protestant iconoclast to where has this been all my life? Or where have I been to this all my life? That surprise, the Eucharist becomes a setting for the vital experience of the presence of Christ rather than just the rock band. And not only is it a vital experience, but it enacts the story of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. And so when one participates in that story every single day in worship, one begins to know the story, and one begins to sense one's own identity in light of that story. So says I. Now, finally, Michael in the back asked a question about reading our existence. So the best way I know to illustrate that is to offer a brief anecdote. There is a rural Methodist church about 30 miles from the Divinity School in North Carolina. It was once a station church, and it was served by a circuit rider who would just show up, you know, every other Sunday because there were multiple small churches out in the country that one pastor had to serve. What's recently gotten a full-time pastor, but it's very much still farm country, surrounded by farms. It's very rural. And heretofore, unprecedented in that community, there was a murder. And some in the community believed that the murder was racially motivated. It happened to be that a person of color was murdered by a white person. And people thought that race was at the heart of the issue of the conflict. And that really stirred the community up. It stirred up racial tensions that hadn't made themselves present prior, or at least for a long time. The church, this little Methodist church, began to pray about how it could be a reconciling presence for that community, how the peace of Christ could be offered in the midst of this tension and this brokenness. But they weren't praying in a vacuum. They were doing a couple things. One was that they were reading the scriptures out of the church's lectionary. And in that period of the church year, happy summer, all the great Old Testament stories get rolled out during the summer in the lectionary. And they happened to be reading stories about Jeremiah, particularly Jeremiah's decision to buy the vineyard at Anatoth, just as the people of Israel were being carted off into exile. And remember, this is a striking prophetic gesture. It's definitely a buyer's market, you know, for real estate, but it's not the shrewdest of economic decisions to buy property when there are fire sales because everybody's getting hauled off to Babylon. So that's one thing, that's one passage that's kind of in the congregational imagination. Jeremiah buys a garden and sets out to cultivate it as a sign of God's promised restoration of the people. The other thing that's going on is that they're sharing Eucharist every week. Okay? So there is preaching on the Word, and there's Eucharist every week. At the same time, a woman in the community, not a member of the church, had a vision. She was happened to be an African-American woman, farmer, and her vision was to give 2 acres of land to this church. She knew not why. So she approached the church and said, "I've had a vision from God. I want to give you 2 acres of my farmland for you to do with what you will. Well, in the imagination of the congregation, there had been regular Eucharistic practice and these passages on Jeremiah and the vineyard. And so the church decided to establish a garden. And the garden, it would be an organic garden. It would use hand tools instead of machines. And this was another important decision, that anybody could become a gardener in the church's garden. You pay $5, and you come and work in the garden on Saturdays, and you get to share in the produce. Now, what they discovered was, their vision was, how do we promote reconciliation? Well, in the garden on Saturdays, you had Hispanic immigrant laborers, African-American farmers and others, Anglo PhD types who teach at one of the Triangle universities. And these people are in there cultivating, weeding, harvesting together. And while they're doing this together, they're talking to one another, building friendships across ethnic lines, racial lines, economic lines. Now, that little garden may not save the planet. It may not fully usher in the reign of God, but it is a gesture that matters. And the gesture was the result of this creative imagination born out of the association of the book, in this case, the book with the table. Okay? So that's what I mean. I forgot the name of the phrase.
Reading our existence.
Reading our existence. So the community is faced with this crisis. How do we respond as a people of peace in the name of Jesus Christ to this crisis? And that's what the fruit of it was. Okay? That's an example, I think, of what the ecology working well might offer to congregations.
Right? Is that the web link that you have on there?
Yes, it is. The web link on the back of your page will take you and let you hear their story better than I told it. So, yes?
That's also your book.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
I think we saw that on the back.
More shameless self-promotion. So I'm teaching out of this book, and I deal as well as with the table. I deal specifically with the book, with the baptismal waters, and with the church's pattern at the time. I'd love for if you work on a church staff if you're a lay youth worker working with ordained clergy, this is something you all might read together, because again, this is about getting us out of our programmatic fiefdoms, youth ministry, choir, preschool, worship, and making it back into the happy mess that it should be. All right, we're just about at time. We have time for another question, if there is such. Yes, sir.
Can you help differentiate a little bit between teaching and reflection? Because it looked like in some of the examples you gave of teaching, there was a lot of reflection kind of questions.
Yes. Yes. Well, it probably I pulled apart two things that I really see operating. I see operating in an intertwined fashion. Another way to think about this would be in ever-proceeding reciprocity between preparing to engage in something, participating in whatever event that is, and then reflecting upon what you've been part of. So action and reflection always held together. Thank you all very much. Hope you have a good time while you're here.